Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Christian Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Mike Mutia. Today we're talking with Georgia Frank about her new book, Unfinished Christians, Ritual Objects and Silent Subjects in Late Antiquity. Georgia is the Charles A. Dana Professor of Religion and Chair of the Department of Religion at Colgate University. And in addition to dozens of chapters and articles, her first book, The Memory of the Eyes, was published by University of California Press in 2000. And for Fordham in 2020, she co-edited with Susan Holman and Andrew Jacobs, The Garb of Being, Embodiment, and the Pursuit of Holiness in Late Ancient Christianity. Georgia's often beautiful and always lucid prose show us not just what early Christians did and thought, but how their rituals and symbols and stories shaped their affective and emotional lives. Before affect theory was everywhere, Georgia was showing us what it was like to taste and see the Eucharist in the 4th century, or how psalms formed memory palaces in monastic imaginations, or how relics and images formed affective grooves in early Christian senses. Her new book, Unfinished Christians, continues to explore early Christian structures of feelings, but it looks not for the celebrities of early Christianity, for those whose stories echoed in martyr shrines and monastic cells and churches. It looks for what she calls ordinary Christians. Most people, after all, didn't fast for weeks or sit on pillars for years. They could barely stay awake through the sermons. Yet it wasn't just the hardcore, the Evagrius or the Simeons, who had to learn how to feel Christian. Training the senses was tricky. It was slow and diffuse, and try as they might, bishops couldn't just tell ordinary Christians how to feel. We circulate affects in less direct but still powerful ways. And so Georgia shows us the spaces and symbols and rituals and collective effervescences that formed new habits, new vibes, new ways of feeling for a growing Christian population in the Roman Empire between the 4th and 6th centuries. So Georgia, welcome. Thank you for being here. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to the project?
Sure. I teach at a small undergraduate college here in the middle of New York State. And at Colgate, I've really taught a whole range of undergraduate courses. And my students are always pushing me to think about who are the real people going about these religious lives. And that's how I've always been interested, is how do we understand the lives of the people, the bodies, the communities of the ancient world? And I got really interested in that through archaeology. I went as an undergraduate myself on an archaeological trip to sites in Greece. And then a few years later, I joined an archaeological team in Western Turkey at a site called Sardis. And I got so interested in how texts might give us one picture of people's lives, but the fragments that are coming out of the ground are showing other dimensions of those lives that don't always get the attention in the text. So that got me interested in pilgrims' descriptions of their travels, other kinds of texts, and the archaeology of pilgrimage. As well as stories about, as you mentioned, these kinds of rock stars or celebrities of antiquity who did superhuman feats of endurance, austerity, fasting, and so on. My attention shifted, though, after I wrote this book on pilgrims, and I got really interested in the people who kind of stayed home, not the people who hit the road. And I especially got to reading a lot of the sermons they listened to and the songs they joined in the context of ritual. And that's what got me on the path of this book about ordinary Christians. And I asked, even though these sermons and songs were written by highly educated church leaders, if we read them a certain way, how can they help us glimpse the lives of those who are in the audience, who are joining in, who are part of their performance? And that's how I kind of thought I would look at spaces where a lot of unnamed Christians, we don't know their names, or even how much they thought of themselves as Christians, but people who gathered in Christian spaces, whether it's the street outdoors or inside churches at night or by day, how did they see the stories they were entering, the stories they were retelling, and how did they sing along with them? How were they prompted to feel their way into them?
Yeah, that's great. And the book's full of these really popping examples, and we'll get to them. But can you tell us a little more about how you try to actually hear these silent subjects? So you mentioned these ancient homilies, and sometimes we get these, you know, great group pictures of, you know, you have a big crowd of busy workers and women and children and old folks. And sometimes we're kind of, you know, peering into the everyday ancient world through other ways, through these material objects that you were talking about, through amulets and slave collars and lamps. And the kind of historian's task is to go from, I don't know, like seeing the amulet or the healing token and saying, well, what kind of worlds do they have to live in for the healing token to make sense, right? So how do we go from object to world or from sermon to subject? And you mentioned in the book a few influences, the historian of modern slavery and its aftermath, the kind of after effects, Cydia Hartman comes up. She calls this work of storytelling amid silent records, critical fabulations. And you also bring up people like Robert Orsi and Nancy Ammerman, who push us to think about lived religion. So can you tell us about how these scholars inspired the projects and maybe how your analysis differs from other work on lived religion?
Yeah. I'll go about it in two parts. I'll start with the things I study and the people who help me study those things. I study to get to ancient people. And I'm talking really about the 4th, 5th, 6th century. And we just happen to have, by sheer luck, some things like we have adult baptism. So you have a lot of sermons and speeches given to adults who are about to join this movement. That's rare. We don't have that kind of record. And what's interesting is that these sermons were delivered over the course of several weeks in the weeks leading up, usually to Easter, when a lot of baptisms were performed. So we have a series for some writers. Objects, I think, also remind us of the bodies that held them, the bodies that manufactured them, the bodies that collaborated with others in making them. And I think the sermons, late ancient sermons are interesting because they were probably, sometimes some of them were transcriptions. And so if there's an outburst, if there's a digression, if there's an aside, those sometimes get recorded too. We have to still study them very carefully and think about the setting for them. But we have a lot of this information, so we can kind of see little glimpses of maybe some of the people in the audience. We also have to read sermons to remember that when somebody is scolding an audience, that the audience might see themselves in a very different way than the scolder. So again, we're reading these things differently. So this is where the work of people like Cydia Hartman and others who would deal with very different kinds of records. But what happens when you're dealing with a body of evidence that was created to minimize or even erase the presence of others? That they don't count, they don't matter. And how do you work with that? Do you say, sources are silent, let's go on and keep studying the elites? Or do you dig a little deeper? And what their work showed me, and I like this term they use, of critical fabulation. This idea is you have to have a sharp eye to kind of not take everything at face value and not read yourself into the silences or what you'd like to say. But there's a little element of fearlessness in their work that always drew me. It's like, come on, we still have some fragment. What can we do with the fragments we do have? And what kind of creativity can we use to fill these gaps? So to me, a silence is an opportunity to enter with imagination instead of to walk away with resignation.
Yeah, it's beautiful. One of the big moves you make once you get into the main chapters of the book is you show us how these working class images of craft, of the kind of the hammering and stamping and chiseling and melting, these things that people in cities would have been doing all day, how they become like lived metaphors, that the spaces people inhabit shape what they felt was normal, but it also shaped what they thought about themselves. So you can dye a shirt, but you can also start dyeing a self. You can sculpt a statue, but you can also sculpt a soul. And so you're reading these homilies around baptism, but it's not like you say, like, well, Cyril of Jerusalem says that baptism is forming a new self, so everyone must have bought it, right? Like, your point, if I'm reading you right, is subtler. It's that those metaphors, they gain purchase because they're already in the bodies of those listening, and the time spent in these workshops, they instill a kind of code of feeling that these images that the preachers are using kind of amplify. And so you show how, you know, with baptism in particular, sometimes it's about, you know, moving from being damned to saved, or there's some kind of, you know, big shift that happens. But then once you get into the details of these sermons, the metaphors that preachers use kind of couldn't help but be slower and more collaborative than that, because life was slower and more collaborative than that. That baptism was more like welcoming a new apprentice, or you write that it's about a lurching process of making and fixing and remaking, than it was more like that than it was like, you know, Paul on the road to Damascus or something. Instant change. So can you kind of take us into these workshops and tell us what we learn about Christian formation by making the workshop the kind of basic space of urban Christian life?
Yeah. So my starting point is to think, okay, we're in the 4th, 5th, 6th centuries. These are the first centuries when Christianity is now legalized. It's we're in urban settings. And as the archaeology of these cities, and I focused mostly on the eastern part of the Mediterranean world, what is today modern Egypt, Turkey, Greece, and so on. And I started thinking, like, workshops were closely attached to homes. They were embedded in the fabric of the city. They were not always zoned on the outskirts of the city, although places like Ephesus, for instance, had workshops and maker spaces, you might say, farther out as well. So anybody who walked through a city, anybody who went into a shop would probably have encountered a workshop, that they were attached to the place where the finished products were sold. They were attached to a home. So if your family was involved in running this business already in childhood, the children in the family would be given some toss-offs or some broken items to play with in the corner to stay busy and to learn how to use certain tools and so on. So to me, it's how embedded workshops were in the fabric of the ancient city. And from there, I thought, so when a preacher uses a metaphor from a workshop, especially in baptismal sermons, isn't this, you know, just kind of trying to touch base with people who are already in the audience? There are artisans in the audience. We have some sermons where they say, "Good morning, I know it's a really busy time for you. I'll keep it short today. And because I know you have to get back to your workshop." So we have craftspeople and artisans in the audience. But I'm saying, even if you were not a craftsperson, you would have encountered these spaces in the course of your daily existence in a way that I think we might forget in the age of, if you live in spaces that are heavily zoned, where manufacturing takes place in a different place than residential areas. So that was the basic space of life. And I got drawn to these workshop metaphors quite by accident. Because in baptism, you often expect, because it's a ritual where you immerse a person in water, that there will be water metaphors. And I was struck by, yes, there are still water metaphors, but there are also a lot of makerspace metaphors. And I wanted to think about, how do you think of yourself as something who is both maker and the object being in the process of being made?
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. So you take us into these workshops, but you also lead us into processions and vigils. And, you know, today people, they often go to church to do their church things. But in antiquity, you write about how they often kind of paraded through streets. And we still see this all over the world, whether that's in Italian Harlem or in villages in El Salvador. But you write about how, you know, these parades, they really matter a lot more than what preachers proclaimed, that they might, you know, listen to the words, but they were thinking about how they were going to hold the statue after he was done talking, or they would feel the aches in their legs from the way they walked. So can you tell us, you know, like, how did it feel to be on a procession? How did it feel to be on those roads? What were they holding? What were they carrying? And then maybe how did those things that they were carrying help Christians form a sense of identity? How did it make them real to themselves?
I think my way of thinking about what's it like to be on those roads, you know, to be in a procession, to be following a group of people as it wends its way through, is to shift from thinking about it, or what are the landmarks you see as you pass by, which major buildings you go by, how do you mark your presence by that building? So let's call that topography, you know, like how do you move through an urban space? I got to thinking a lot that in antiquity, there were, first of all, a lot of processions in the ancient city. You would see in a religiously diverse setting, like an Eastern Roman city, you'd see a lot of different religious groups going through the city. And how would you know what the group was? It's usually by what they carried. And inscriptions we have of non-Christian processions often will say, there's one famous inscription from Ephesus, which lists all the things that get carried in a procession and the weight of each, how heavy each one was. And I thought the names of some inscriptions, each participant, each role one played in the procession, you were known by the name, you were named by what you carried. If you carried a basket, you were the basket carrier. If you carried a knife, because these were sacrificial processions, you were a knife carrier. And so I thought, why is it that early Christian processions never really mention what people are carrying explicitly? So is it that Christians don't need objects, or they were object free, or somehow anti-object? And I started digging more, and I found that your identity was often bound up by what you were carrying as well. If you were carrying even a torch, you were a religion of the night. You moved through the darker spaces of the city. If you carried a book, sometimes they carried tools as they were making a procession, in at least a story about a procession of going to tear down a non-Christian temple. And how much the object you're carrying, first of all, shapes your gait. If you think about it, you're carrying heavy. If you were ever in marching band and had a big brass instrument or big, you know, think about the instrument you had to carry. Yeah. How did you, what was the exertion you had to do to stay in lockstep with the others? Think about the marching band. And I think you've got the picture of how does it shape your gait? How does it shape what pace you take, how long your strides are? Your endurance as well through some cities. So I got to thinking about the physicality of the objects that Christians carry. It made me also think back to these baptismal sermons. Those are about workshops helped me think about the breakable object, the object that's prone to wear and tear, the object that needs repair, the object. So objects gave me a lens for remembering the bodies that are involved in doing Christianity. And in the doing, I think, is where identity starts to take shape. So I never think of conversion as a fixed identity. Even dies, which is something that's used to describe that it's fixed. Even a die fades eventually. Mm. And so so I think objects really help me think about the lives of things and how they can kind of come apart, how they depend on others to stay intact and so on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's reminding me of that David Graeber quote that, you know, most of our lives is about maintaining things that you make a cup once, you watch it 1,000 times. And there's something about the kind of the procession that has that going too. Yeah. So the next two chapters are a lot about, The next two chapters, they're a lot about, night vigils, but also about the way liturgies you talk about them as layering emotions. So maybe we can take these in two different parts. You talk about how liturgies, they give a sense of a different kind of time that can be operative, and that you write about them as a way to kind of practice or rehearse or simulate kind of complicated emotions that people feel, that you know, we often think about, you know, the preacher or the church leader as kind of telling people what to do exactly. But you write about how these liturgies, they gave people a chance to kind of process those, you know, ugly feelings or complicated emotions. Can you talk about kind of how liturgies do that, how the songs and the kind of recitations give people a chance to talk?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll say a little bit about liturgies first. Like, I think a liturgy is a ritual, and it includes, not only in early Christian rituals, it includes not only readings from the Bible. So, the story that you might be commemorating on that feast day, that passage will be read. But it will include also a sermon, and I've talked about the sermons. It will also include maybe the night before you might gather and start telling that story. So a night vigil, you might stay up late the night before and until the service the next morning. It also includes a lot of singing, which is often drawn from the Psalms. And you won't necessarily always sing a whole psalm, but you might, between readings, sing a couple verses from the Psalms. So all that goes into liturgy. And yet, if you only look at the Bible, I think you miss that there are many other layers of emotions going on. Sometimes the psalm that's chosen, and we don't have the melodies anymore, so we can't really guess what it, you know, what the sound was like. But you can kind of see that a psalm might echo the emotion in the story. So if it's a story about something joyous, the psalm will be a verse of, you know, will be a verse of joy. That's great. It aligns with it. But sometimes what I was finding is that the story itself had one emotion and the psalm had a quite different emotion, even in, one might say, an opposite emotion. So let's take an example. Last Sunday was Palm Sunday, which is the day that commemorates when Jesus enters into Jerusalem, and he's met with acclamation and joy, and, you know, hallelujahs is the exclamation. It's also the day that marks his entry into the final week of his life. And it is the day, the week of his his arrest, his death, and right into Easter. So it's Holy Week. I started looking at how the Psalms interacted with this story. Did the Psalms kind of temper the joy in the entry into Jerusalem by having some kinds of Psalms associated, you know, anticipating what's coming up in the week ahead, of sorrow, of worry, of betrayal, of frustration. And so that's where I started looking into the mixed emotions. And I saw that also, even like on Christmas morning, one sermon I looked at, the sermon was all the good stuff you expect on Christmas morning sermon, you know, a nativity story. And yet it's also talking about eventually in the next chapter of Matthew, there's a massacre of babies going on under Herod. And it's violent. It's horrid. And so these are, even sermons are doing these kinds of what one scholar has called roller coaster rhetoric. The idea of you're on a high and then it comes crashing down. It's a lot of, you might even say, whiplash from such a jarring. So I was always interested, what effect do these sermons have? Is it being more honest that we're complicated beings with mixed feelings? Does it also help you think about time? It's not just one festival. You're part of a year of festivals. You're part of a much bigger story. This one episode is part of a really mixed story. And so that's why I got very interested in emotions and how they get filtered and recombined through feast days. So thinking about time and emotions. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. 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 And so can we talk specifically about night vigils? You give us a whole chapter on this, and there's a way that, like, the processions, they kind of bind groups together. There's like a sing together, stay together kind of thing. But then there's this, you know, like, and you talk about these layerings of emotions, but then there's something specific about night. Like you quote John Chrysostom saying that God is more moved by prayers at night. And whether that's a theological statement or not, it is a pretty cinematic one. Like the parent awake in the middle of the night praying for the child is a really different image than, the, I don't know, like healthy minded person praying easily at noon. And a lot of nocturnal worship, it depends on the fact that people slept differently before electric lights and coffee and things like that. So can you tell us about how these sleep patterns differ? And then, like, what are these night vigils like? Like, what are people actually doing? Are they waking up in the middle of the night and you're gathering? And what kind of emotions do you see happening in these night vigils?
I got really interested in the history of night. And the history of night in the before the age of electricity I got interested in it in two ways, is that we slept differently, that we would tend to wake up in the middle of the night for a few hours, do some other activities, all kinds of activities, and then go back to sleep and sleep some more. The industrialization, the 8-hour workday, factories changed, and artificial light changed those sleep patterns. So that explains, I think, how many, you didn't have to be an extreme monk to be getting up in the middle of the night. A lot of people were waking up. And so preachers would kind of say, use that time to do prayer. Use that time while your family, even if the rest of your family is asleep, you can imagine what the future of the world might look like. You can, you know, so they even guided some of these meditations. It was kind of like the headspace of the ancient world. And the sleep patterns, I think, got me thinking about what might ritual at these times look like when people left their homes and went into to gather in a church. And that's what I call the night vigil, and on the eve of a service. And so I got to thinking about, well, how did illumination work in these spaces? First of all, which cities had outdoor illumination? Was it safe to walk through the streets at night to get to the church? Okay, Antioch, we know in the 4th century, already starts having a lot of urban outdoor illumination. Once you're in the church, so archaeologists have reminded us how lamps worked, how many lamps. We have a lot of how mosaics reflected, how different objects reflected light. So the light there might be a time of a lot of shadows. It might not be what we would consider a very bright light. So how does storytelling in a dimly lit space, as you're singing along with others, sometimes identifying with the characters in the story? And I got to thinking that maybe night allows us to think about stories that are themselves set at night. And I got interested in these songs about people's interior thoughts and dilemmas that happen at night. And I got really interested in what it feels like to participate in telling a story that itself set at night, where somebody's expressing their deepest doubts and fears and vulnerabilities. And so the archaeology helped me picture the way light worked in those spaces, and the stories helped me imagine how you might identify with some characters or feel towards others in different ways.
Yeah, that's great. So kind of stepping back, we're getting towards the end, but I'm wondering if you could help us think kind of more broadly about being a historian and going for these, you know, kind of silent subjects. So, you know, the book looks at these homilies and it spends a lot of time with liturgy. And that's not the way historians usually try to understand everyday people. Like the more common approach is, as you were saying, to look at the archaeology or climate and disease and law and those kinds of things. And sometimes there's even, I don't know, like a sense of cynicism. Like, you know, I mean, come on, like people didn't really care what Romano said. Like, you know, like we, you know, both of us have sat through sermons or lectures that are full of analogies and some of them resonate and some of them just kind of bounce right off. Right. And And of course, that happened in antiquity, too. You know, John Chrysostom tells his congregants to form themselves like pottery, but he also complains that they aren't paying attention or that they go to the racetrack instead of the church. And so you're bringing in those other disciplines, but you insist that these like ritual moments, they were really important and that we can't just be cynical about them. And so, you know, that's this kind of critical imagination that you're looking at. So, you know, one, like, how do we avoid the problem of assuming that the rhetoric just worked, right? Like, and sometimes like we can assume that, you know, wrongly that people just, you know, believed everything that John Chrysostom said because he was John Chrysostom. But also the thing that you're looking for in this, these kind of critical fabulations is that there's these kind of some metaphors resonate more than others. That, I don't know, Gregory of Nyssa will give four analogies to make the same point. And you're going to pick up one of those and say that that's the one that matters. So as a historian, kind of how do you learn how to listen for those details that pop?
That's a really great question. I think I don't take for granted that whatever a preacher says goes. But I do have to remember that somebody showed up for that service. Mm-hmm. Some, he might complain that attendance is a little thin today. You know, he might scold people at the next one. Oh, it's nice to see you here. You skipped the last few Sundays. So I have to know that I can't say I have a critical mass, but there's somebody in the audience. And I think trying to bring the audience into the mix is really important. I want to kind of think about the frequency of a metaphor or the recurrence of a metaphor. What might that do? To me, it was just, I had noticed these maker metaphors in terms of drawing and painting. That's what I first got interested in these sermons. It's only later that I realized that it's wood carving, that it's actually what we would call conservation or repair. You know, so it dawns, I'm a slow learner that way. It dawns on me little by little that there are more of them than I imagined. And it also helps that we have now archaeologists digging up these spaces. Like, we have an archaeology of apprenticeship. We see what a practice object or an unfinished object looks like. We know that there were many hands involved in it and it was collaborative. So I start, it's sometimes the cues from the material evidence tells me to go back and look at the sources and see again, oh wait, baptism's a pretty collaborative process. We think it's one person going through an initiation rite. But when you start understanding better who's the staff, what are they doing, who is watching, the archaeology of baptistries and even the dressing rooms. I got really interested in, you know, are there hooks in these dressing rooms? Is this where you let, you know, you hang up your clothes if this ritual was done nude, and so on. So I would say it is really, it's by circling back and thinking, you know, what is archaeology revealing about these spaces? And they're getting a lot more attention, which is nice to see. And how am I reading the sermons differently? So I don't have the actual church, the physical actual church where the sermon, but I have a sense of what it's like to be moving through a city to get to your church. So yeah, I there's a lot, it is a lot of uncertainty, and I think that's the fearlessness that I like in some of the theorists who help me think. Lived religion is about understanding ordinary people's lives. Not that they're trying to do something to undermine their leaders, but they just might be going about something differently. Where can we find the clues? And so there is an ancient lived religion project, which really inspired me, and certainly American religion, because it thinks about groups in a really nice way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Great. Well, you know, we've taken a lot of your time. So thank you. But two more questions, if I can. One, another kind of, you know, backing up question, you know, some people listening will be specialists, you know, they will know who John Chrysostom is or, you know, know who Romanos is, whatever. But for people who aren't, you know, the generalists, for, you know, students or pastors or generalists, you know, what do you hope someone picking up the book, you know, it's short, it's readable, it's a great book. But what do you hope they would take from the book, even if they aren't going to read the Greek?
I would say, first of all, to pay more attention to crowds, to think that people do things together, and within a crowd, to think that that everybody might be in it for different reasons. Does one need to be, you know, what does the label Christian mean today? That's something a lot of people argue about. I don't think people were that invested. Some people were not that invested in the label, but just showed up to be part of something. And so that, to me, is where I find people who make religion happen are not necessarily innovators or necessarily full-time all in. They might be feeling Christian some days of the week and feeling something else another day of the week. So I think what I like is just how do we pay attention to the nameless crowd and see different ways of life within that crowd. It is kind of what draws me.
Yeah. I got that. I mean, there's this wonderful way that you kind of acknowledge that, yes, you know, in a group of 50 people, there are 50 different reasons for being there and 300 things going on in their heads at any time. And yet the kind of cumulative effect of them all being there also matters. And that, yeah, sometimes when we focus on lived religion, we can, you know, rightly go for the individual, and we can forget that the group dynamic really does make people as much as, you know, what's going on in any individual's head at any time.
And to think about an individual, sometimes religious identity has been explained to me as how an individual adheres to the rules or beliefs of their religion. And I thought, what if we put what people do and where people are ahead of what do they believe about the transcendent or so on. If I can't have access to someone's beliefs, can I still understand what stories somebody feels that they're part of? Can you be part of a story and, you know, share the space with others? So I'm thinking about early Christianity not as a time of bowling alone, as a sociologist of religion once said, the idea of, you know, the individual, but of how groups come together, and wherever I can find through fragments. And that's really the study of antiquity. How can we pay attention to the fragments before us?
Yeah, that's great. Okay, last question. What are you working on now?
Well, I have been working on a legend. It's a shift. This legend is called The Seven Sleepers. It's kind of like a story of seven young men who, to escape persecution, hide in a cave in Western Turkey often, and they fall asleep for hundreds of years and awake to find that now the empire, they have a Christian emperor and everything is good again. And so I got interest in this legend because, first of all, it was a stop on pilgrims' journeys on the way. They would pass through this part of Asia Minor or Turkey on their way to or back from Jerusalem. And I just got interested in this language. This legend just has legs. It gets translated into so many ancient languages and also medieval languages. A version of it finds its way into the Quran, even. It is mentioned in the Quran. It's the Surah of the Cave, as it's known. So I'm starting to think about that, about what's it like, and to think about through the Rip Van Winkle stories of our own, of what's it like to outlive everyone you love? What's it like to wake up in a new world? These stories are often around cataclysmic change. So that's my new project, The Seven Sleepers, is what I've been thinking about. Yeah. Thank you for asking.
Great. Yeah. Well, we look forward to reading that when it comes out. Georgia, thank you so much for being here. It's such a pleasure to talk to you, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you. And thanks for having me, Mike.